Lover complained to the New York City government when he was ignored hailing a cab standing on a Manhattan street corner. He claimed that it was racism that so many cabbies drove by without picking him up. More recently, Oprah Winfrey also charged racial discrimination after she was denied entry at a fancy clothing store in Paris. Clarence Thomas charged that he was a victim of high-tech lynching at his contentious Supreme Court nomination hearing. And Michael Jackson blamed his low record sales on a racist conspiracy by his record company. My guest, Richard Thompson Ford, uses these anecdotes and many others in his new book, and it's called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Ford says that playing the race card involves, quote, false and exaggerated claims of bias that piggyback on real instances of victimization. Richard Thompson Ford is a law professor at Stanford Law School, and he joins us on Radio Time to talk about race, racism, and the race card. And Richard Thompson Ford, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let me begin at the very end of your book. You say the race card is really a crisis of success. How so?
Well, the civil rights movement has succeeded in making racism taboo. It's not acceptable, and most people not only try to hide their biases, but I think it's fair to say that most people really try to overcome their biases. Doesn't mean they always succeed, and I certainly don't want to argue that racism is a thing of the past, but there has been a remarkable social transformation in that respect. The result has been that people often sometimes make claims of racism that in circumstances where the facts are ambiguous. It's hard to tell because people are unlikely to exhibit racism openly. So that's one way in which it's a crisis of success. Another is that we've got a kind of good news, bad news story where some aspects of race relations are getting a lot better. Racial attitudes are getting better, I think, by every reliable sociological measure. But at the same time, the condition of the black underclass is in some ways getting worse. Isolation in urban ghettos is worse. The incarceration rates for young black men is worse than in the era of Jim Crow. Joblessness is in some communities worse. And so that's led us to not have the same way to talk about race that we once did. It's not necessarily racist, but there's still real racial problems.
So in 2008, what is racial bias? I mean, how do you even define that? If there have been these successes, and if there are also enduring problems or ongoing problems, and if racism has either gone underground or people have actually gotten over some of their discriminatory ideas and attitudes.
Absolutely. I think there are two aspects of racial bias, and part of the problem of playing the race card is collapsing these two things together. One is outright racial animus, and that hasn't gone away, and there are instances of it. But as I suggest, there are fewer of them, and there are a lot of cases where it's hard to tell.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's what I call racism without racists. And that's a set of social conditions that are the result of racism in the past that lead to real racial inequities that need to be addressed, but for which there's no obvious racist to blame. And the tendency in today's conversations about race is to think that if there's racism, there has to be a racist. So sometimes people look for a racist to pin to the dartboard, when, in fact, there's no racist to blame. On the other side, people think if there's no racist, then there's no problem. And both of those attitudes are wrong, I think.
Well, you say an example of racism without racists is Hurricane Katrina and its impact on New Orleans and how the country reacted and what we saw.
Right. So obviously, the results of the aftermath of Katrina affected African Americans to vastly disproportionate to their numbers in the country and even to their numbers in New Orleans. People said, for instance, the famous example of the rapper Kanye West, George Bush doesn't care about black people. Well, I think,
and that was the explanation for the inaction of government.
Right. Right, exactly. For the failure of the FEMA efforts. I think that distracts attention from the real problems. One, the Bush administration was I think it's fair to say, ideologically predisposed to be contemptuous of social programs generally, and that included FEMA, which it's pretty well documented they staffed with political hacks at the top rather than experienced professionals. There were a lot of the professionals in FEMA were disgruntled about that at the time, and they put underneath the Department of Homeland Security, where the disaster relief mandate was watered down by the counterterrorism agenda, and those were in part responsible for the bungled response to Hurricane Katrina. Also, neighborhood segregation, a problem in cities across the country. A big part of the reason African Americans were so disproportionately affected was because the poor black neighborhoods were in the less desirable parts of New Orleans, which were low-lying areas, and they were the most severely impacted by the storm. The areas in higher ground, the French Quarter, the Garden District, predominantly white, were less severely impacted.
But you could also, using that example, say that poor people and poor black people in New Orleans living in these more vulnerable areas were there because of racial segregation laws,
yes,
because of poor education, because of poor job opportunities, and that's a legacy in part of racism.
Absolutely, yes. That's why I want to say racism without racists, because the reason those neighborhoods are predominantly black is racism. But it's racism in the past. It's not that George Bush doesn't care about black people today, or at least, you know, any more than he doesn't care about poor whites or people in states that aren't politically salient to the Republican Party. And I talk a bit about that.
Right.
You know, they think that's a plausible explanation for inaction politics, more so than racial bias today. But yes, absolutely, the legacy of segregation is responsible for the isolation of the black poor today.
But using that as an example, and as you say, when Kanye West says, you know, George W. Bush doesn't care about black people, you seem to indicate in this book that those kinds of charges of racism are conversation stopper.
Yes, absolutely. You know, that, and that's one of the biggest problems. We need to have a better conversation about race and racial injustice, one in which people are willing to voice a variety of opinions. I think we need new approaches. And saying someone's a racist, the fear that as soon as race is introduced, it involves necessarily an accusation of racial bias, that shuts down conversation. Mm-hmm. I think once you've said someone's a racist, the almost inevitable response is digging in of the heels and defensiveness. So it's a tit for tat. You're a racist. No, you're just playing the race card.
And you're saying that's kind of where the conversation is today. It's kind of stuck at this point.
I think so.
Well, but using the hailing the cab example, and I mentioned Danny Glover, but you know, a number of black men, African American men, have had the same kind of experience where they're hailing a cab. In fact, you write about it in the book.
Yeah.
Your own experience. You hail a cab. You see other people being picked up. You don't see yourself being picked up, so to speak. Now, some would say that is racism, and maybe on the part of some of those cabbies, they are racist. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't want to pick up a black man, and they're willing to pick up a white man or a white woman. But how do you know under those circumstances?
That's exactly the problem, that you really don't. And so one of the taxi cab example, you may know over the run of instances that some of it's got to be race, but you don't know in any particular instance. That's one. Two, there's a difference between the cab driver being a bigot. I just don't like black people. And I don't deny that there are, you know, I'm sure there are bigots among cab drivers just as there are among the general population. I don't think cab drivers are more likely to be bigots than any other group of people. And I don't think that kind of bigotry explains most of the problem. When you talk to cab drivers, and I've tried to seek out their opinions and find out what's going on, they'll say, you know, some people don't want to go to far-flung neighborhoods or neighborhoods that they consider to be dangerous, and they're using race as a proxy for neighborhood. It's not a perfect proxy, but it's a reasonable one. And given that they can't make a decision based on neighborhood, once they stopped, you know, they have to take the person to anywhere in the five boroughs they want to go, if it's New York, they use this as a proxy. You know, it's not the nicest or the most noble thing, but it's different than racial bigotry.
But that's racial profiling, is it not? I mean,
yeah.
it sees a black man standing on the corner and makes a certain judgment about who this person is.
Right. No, that's right. And at an individual level, it's certainly unfair. At a collective level, mm-hmm. I think it's sort of understandable. And I can see why it happened. So the question then becomes, what can we do about it? Now, what we do about it if we thought these are just bigots who are acting on the basis of completely irrational prejudice would be what the Giuliani administration, in fact, did, have a crackdown.
You must pick up people that are hailing a cab, essentially?
Yes.
Or some version of that?
Right. In fact, what they did was they had a sting operation, and if they thought that a cab driver had passed one passenger in favor of another, they'd cite the person on the spot. And the Giuliani administration actually, in some cases, impounded people's cabs and yanked their hack licenses. So it was kind of a summary justice process, and then they had to go to trial to get their license back. Mm. Now that sounds right if you think these are just bigots and they deserve the most severe punishment you can mete out. On the other hand, if you think that there's something more complicated going on, there may be other solutions that are more likely to be effective. And at the very least, we could talk about them. So, the larger underlying problem is neighborhood segregation. Obviously, we're not going to fix that overnight, but it would be worth noting that is the underlying problem, not just irrational racial animus. And we might start to think about why cab drivers don't want to go to certain neighborhoods and what we can do to get them to go to certain neighborhoods, because a crackdown in the end isn't really going to work, and I think it's fair to say it hasn't worked. I don't think if you went to Harlem, people would say, oh yeah, now everything's great and it's easy to get cabs in Harlem. So what can we do to get better service in black neighborhoods? And that may be a different answer.
Well, and a more complicated one, as you say, the problem, it sounds like the most pernicious problem, as you describe it, in this country, is residential segregation, is the level of segregated housing in the country.
I think so. I think that, that's the number one racial injustice in our society, and almost all the other ones flow from it in one way or another. Segregated neighborhoods with poor, underfunded, failing schools, with conditions where joblessness is the norm, with high crime rates, in part because the conditions in those neighborhoods are such that for many people, crime seems to be, at any rate, the only option. And so all these things work together to produce a whole set of racial problems and kind of a vicious cycle. Mm-hmm. That's hard to break out of.
Well, and we're almost on a break here, but going back to the guy on the street corner and the cabbie driving by, I mean, the solution sounds like a systemic one to this interaction between a black man on the corner and a cabbie driving by.
Absolutely. I think it is a systemic one. And, the big, larger solution is to do something about neighborhood segregation so that these neighborhoods aren't places where cab drivers don't want to go. The shorter-term solution may have to do with just incentives for cab drivers. But if you look at the problem more holistically, you might say, well, gee, what we need to do is subsidize the cab drivers going to neighborhoods that are dangerous so they'd be more likely to want to go there. Now, some people may think, well, that seems offensive that you'd have to pay the cab drivers to do it. But realistically, there's a reason that the cab drivers don't want to go to neighborhoods that they consider to be dangerous. And we need to look at that.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Richard Thompson Ford. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Race Card, and it's subtitled How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. And he's a law professor at Stanford Law School. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Christiana Care supports WHYY and your efforts to stay healthy. Christiana Care is offering a free online heart risk assessment available at christianacare.org/heart test. By answering a few questions about your health and lifestyle, you can find out if you could be at risk for heart disease. Online at christianacare.org/heart test for an online heart risk assessment.
I'm Marnie Moscowane. If you enjoy Radio Times on 91 FM, check out the TV version of the show Friday night at 8 on TV 12. This Friday, we get ready for the Academy Awards with a conversation with the writer and the director of Juno and the writer-director of The Savages. Both films have been nominated for Oscars. That's Radio Times on TV, Friday night at 8 on WHYY TV 12.
Muqtada al-Sadr is threatening to end his Shiite militia's ceasefire. At the same time, some Sunni militias backed by the U.S. in Iraq to fight al-Qaeda are growing restless. On the next Fresh Air, a view of Iraq from the ground with Patrick Coburn, Iraq correspondent for The Independent in London. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Richard Thompson Ford about the meaning of racism, the charge of racism, and how it can be abused and sometimes confusing. His book is called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. And we do have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. But going back to racial profiling, we mentioned that in talking about the cabbie and the black man on the corner who's right. hailing a cab. But police departments use racial profiling. I mean, I think they say that they aren't, but racial profiling is something that is used to try to manage traffic or even people at airports. Are you troubled by racial profiling at all? And do you see that as playing the race card because it's using a certain stereotype about individuals?
Yes. I mean, I am troubled by it, but I don't think that we can entirely eliminate it. Race is salient in our society. There are salient racial differences that everyone's aware of, and sometimes it makes sense for people to consider race when making some set of decisions, even if it's a generalization. Now, it's worth, you know, it's important to point out that this can be unfair to individuals, but as a collective matter, it may be important. And I think if the stakes are high enough, it may sometimes be a price that, as citizens, we need to pay.
But if you're, let's say, an Arab American, you know, an Iraqi American or someone from the Middle East, and you get stopped at an airport because of your name and your appearance, you're saying that's just kind of the price of living in a complex world or even a dangerous world?
Yeah, I am saying that. Now, it's important to say that a lot depends on what happens after the person is stopped. I think it's imperative that law enforcement understand that when they stop somebody, and particularly when they're using some sort of a profile that includes race, you know, and it's worth noting that real profiles include more than just race. Usually there are other factors. But when they're doing that, they're stopping a lot of innocent people. They're putting a burden on a lot of innocent people, and they need to be as courteous and make the process as painless as possible. But I wouldn't say that that law enforcement should never be able to consider race.
What I've heard from some of the shows we've done about racial profiling is the people whose job it is to monitor people saying that race is actually not the first criteria. It might mm-hmm. be the third or the fourth or the fifth or the tenth criteria, that it's behavior and then race. But I think as a kind of shorthand, race becomes the criteria.
Right. I think, you know, that's right. And, you know, one thing to notice about racial profiling, the burden on someone who's profiled because of race isn't really distinguishable from the burden on someone who's fits the description of a criminal suspect. So in a way, there's a spectrum, and everybody, even the ACLU, Amnesty International, would agree that law enforcement can consider race when they're dealing with an actual suspect description. Now, the truth is, suspect descriptions are notoriously unreliable.
Yes, they are.
And, you know, I mean, a famous case in Oneonta, New York, a woman was assaulted. The only thing she could say about the assailant was it was a black man. You know, it was dark. She couldn't see. Was he short? Didn't know. Was he tall? Didn't know. Fat? Only thing she knew was that he was black. But that was a suspect description, and the police rounded up every black man in the town. Now, no one calls that racial profiling, and almost everyone agrees that the police are entitled to do something like that. But, you know, over 300 innocent black people were stopped by the police in Oneonta. So sometimes, you know, we've got to consider race.
Sure. Well, moving on and introducing another idea in your book having to do with racism, as you call it, racism by analogy.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, one of the aspects of the success of the civil rights movement is that a lot of people now want to analogize their issues to racism. It's like racism.
Like sexism or homophobia.
Right. Or And bias against the overweight, or bias against smokers, to take an extreme example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all of these are groups that have said, you know, it's like racism. If this were black people, no one would allow it. One example, Southwest Airlines has a policy. They call it their customer of size policy. But the policy is that if you're too overweight to fit in the coach class seat and fold down both of the armrests, they'll make you buy two seats. And, you know, as you can imagine, immediately some of the activist groups for the overweight said, this is outrageous discrimination. If it were black people, everyone would be against it. You know, it's like making Rosa Parks sit in the back of the bus, this kind of thing. So that's an example of racism by analogy.
But you don't buy that.
No, I don't. Now, I don't want to say that people should never be able to make the analogy, because as you mentioned, sexism, mm-hmm. homophobia, in many cases, the analogy is apt. But here, for instance, it's not quite the same thing. There's an objective cost involved with someone who's too large to fit in the coach class seat, which is either the airline loses revenue, and in an airline like Southwest with slim margins, that may be a problem for their business model, or someone else is deprived of their share of scarce space. If you sit in coach class, space is at a premium. In fact, some of the airlines were sued by passengers who were squeezed against a very overweight person, and there were several fairly high-profile lawsuits. So, you know, there's more at stake. And in the end, we're talking about a subsidy and how to just, you know, it's really a distributive question that needs to be answered.
The title of that chapter is Fat is Not the New Black,
yes.
Just to underscore what you're saying there. But it sounds like what you're saying is several things. One is that there is an economic cost to using your example of the airline, but are you also saying that when it comes to skin color or sexual orientation, that these are not things that people choose to do? These are things that people are. But when it comes to how much you eat or how much you weigh, that's your personal choice, and you are not protected as a class of people because of your lifestyle or choice?
Yes, although I don't want to put too much weight on that. I mean, I think, but it is true that there's a question of the ability to change, and in law, courts refer to immutability. Many courts
immutability.
So the characteristics protected under the Civil Rights Act are considered to be immutable characteristics. Now, religion's an exception, and we could have a long conversation about that. But many courts consider immutability to be a central feature. And part of it has to do with the ability of people to change, and some has to do with the desirability of change as well. I think it's fair to say that even if we thought, for instance, gay men and lesbians could change, they have a perfectly valid argument, well, why should we? Mm. There's no social cost to, you know, there's no reason that our lifestyle or our sexual orientation should be dispreferred. Now, on the other hand, when we're talking about obesity, it's a serious health problem, and to the extent that people can lose weight, it would be good for society. So there's a reason there to make a distinction.
But that could open the door to an employer saying, I will not hire you to be the receptionist because you're overweight. I mean, is that a form of race, well, in this case, I guess, a discrimination because you are making a judgment about someone and denying them the right to a job?
Yeah. You know, I think it's important to note that the civil rights laws that we currently have enumerate a set of prohibited considerations, right, and that everything else is allowed. Now, there's a reason for that. Generally, we trust employers and the market to produce the right distinctions, and we don't micromanage the decisions of employers. That doesn't mean that all the decisions that employers make are fair or justifiable. There's lots of unfairness in the labor market. But I think in the context of something like weight, it's really more analogous to the broad range of unfairness that happens in the labor market all the time. Now, we could move to a system where everyone has to, where employers have to show cause for all of their decisions. Mm-hmm. But I think then we need to examine the cost of that as opposed to the system we have now, the administrative costs and the risk that courts and government would get it wrong. But I think that's the real analogy. It's not analogous to race, where we have a real serious set of social divisions in our society that are longstanding and the result of explicit and quite vicious discrimination in the past. You know, they think there's a distinction to be made there.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We do have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Richard Thompson Ford is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a law professor at Stanford Law School, and he's the author of a new book called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Let me just ask you one more question before we get to our cause, because what you're saying is that playing this race card really prevents what you think is the real and important conversation the country's supposed to have about, I guess, race and race relations and how we're supposed to all get along and understand each other. How does playing the race card prevent that conversation? If you were to remove the race card, what would we talk about?
Well, I think we'd talk about things like neighborhood segregation. We'd talk about racial injustices as a collective social problem that requires social solutions. We'd talk about the legacy of our quite explicitly racist past. And, you know, we wouldn't stop talking about bigotry. I want to be clear that I'm not arguing that bigotry is a thing of the past, but we would reserve the term racist and bigot for those circumstances in which it's real racial animus, and we'd talk about the wide range of other racial injustices in a less emotionally charged language, but we'd still talk about them.
You say here to look at racial injustice as a social problem to be solved collectively rather than a series of discrete wrongs perpetrated by bad people. Mm-hmm. And I guess what you're saying here is the idea is that if there is this conversation, everyone is entitled to sit around the table. Because sometimes I think in conversations, white people are accused of not having a place at the table because right. They've never been discriminated against the way black people have or other racial minorities.
Right. No, that's right. And that absolutely that we need everyone at the table. It's race relations. And you don't have a relationship, you know, with only one side there. I'm always troubled when someone says, you know, I try to talk about these issues, but I'm told that as a white person, you know, I don't have the right to weigh in. I don't think we'll get anywhere unless we hear from a broad cross-section of the population.
And when someone says, you people, you know, as we heard in the 1990s, the idea that when people sit down at the table together, sometimes they don't know what words to use or what language to use, and things are loaded in this conversation.
Absolutely. You know, I do think that we should be a little bit less uptight about language and terminology and try not to take offense at what may be, you know, innocent slips of the tongue or innocent comments.
Let me get some callers into the conversation. We've got Rick from Yardley joining us. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
It's really nice to hear your guest. You know, he's willing to take a look at a lot of realities that people don't talk about. However, there's two things I'd like to point out. One is the myth that the inner city schools have less money per student than the average high quality suburban schools. If you look at all the money they receive, federal, state, and local, it's not like they're losing money. And I'd say, too, the only solution to a high crime neighborhood must come from the residents themselves. They must become informed voters.
Well,
and active.
Well, Rick, let me just disagree with you, because if you look at the money that is spent in Philadelphia per pupil, it's something like $6,000-$8,000. And if you look at suburban Philadelphia, in some cases, it's twice that much money.
Hey, can I say something? You're not including federal and state money in that number.
No, I believe I'm including all the money. I mean, I think that's an interesting issue, but I'm not sure it speaks directly to some of the.
I wish you would look into that and report on it.
I will indeed. I will indeed. But let me give our guest a chance to respond.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
Yeah, in terms of underfunded schools, you know, I think Schools in the United States typically are funded by local property taxes. Now, there is federal and state money, it's true, but local property taxes are typically a big feature, and so neighborhoods with less valuable property tend to get less money. Not always true, and it is the case that even poor inner-city schools that have a lot of funding can sometimes still be failing, in part because they have greater needs. If you're in a high-crime area, the school may need to spend more on security. They're spending more on things that suburban schools don't have to spend money on. I'm not arguing that money is the only issue, but it is one.
Well, and Rick also raised the point of you know, if people in the neighborhood have problems, those are problems they need to solve themselves. Do you see that as a solution?
No, I don't. I mean, I see it as only a partial solution. I think that this is really a collective problem, that what you've got is you know, a vicious cycle where generation after generation are kind of locked into a social milieu that in some cases is quite severely isolated from the mainstream of society. And people naturally develop norms that are functional within the inner city community, within the gray market, for instance, but aren't particularly functional outside that community. And so they have a hard time getting out into the mainstream economy. I don't think the only solution to that can be individual responsibility. We've got to find, you know, it's really a collective problem. It started as a result of segregation that was imposed by government and by a whole range of private actors, and I think we do need a social solution to get started, you know, now, as well as personal responsibility.
Rick, thanks for the call. Let me get Don from Germantown to join us. Hi, Don. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hey, like I was telling you, Marty, when I was a kid growing up in Germantown, I used to walk down the street, maybe up Shelton Avenue, which is a shopping district, and it was a mixed neighborhood. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm just looking around, maybe walking with a friend, you know, a woman in front of me, regardless of her color, would clutch her pocketbook, you know, and I would get the impression like this woman is thinking I'm going to rob her because I'm a black man. But as I got older, I realized that it wasn't just me she was thinking out because I was black. It was because of the images that she has seen, the information that she has seen that put this in her mind.
You know,
and I'd like to ask your guest, don't you think it's the responsibility of the group that's being stereotyped to change these stereotypes, to do something about it? You know, like if I live in a high crime area, should it be the responsibility of the people that are in that area as a collective to do something about that, to change the stereotype? And then also, aren't we all guilty of some type of racism? Thank you. I'll listen off air.
Dan, thanks. Don, excuse me. Thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Great. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think the responsibility is really broader than just the people that are being stereotyped. To be sure, you know, personal responsibility is part of the answer, but stereotypes come from the media. I think we've lived in a society where, I remember television in the 70s was just filled with some pretty vicious racial stereotypes. And if you look back at, you know, some of these shows, it's kind of shocking. The media's gotten better, but those stereotypes are still in people's minds. Today, racial stereotypes come through, by and large, come from things like gangster rap. So to that extent, you know, yes, it is African Americans now who are perpetuating some stereotypes, and some of these are as vicious as anything the Christy Minstrels could have come up with. So that's a problem as well, but we do have you know, a media that's perpetuating some of these racial stereotypes, And that needs to change as well. So I think the responsibility is broader than just the people living in those neighborhoods.
Don, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's take a very short break, then we'll get back to our conversation and get back to our callers as well. We're talking with Richard Thompson Ford today on Radio Times, talking about race, racism, and the race card. In fact, his new book is called The Race Card, and it's subtitled How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Actually, after this break, I do want to talk to you about affirmative action, because you have a section in the book about that as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Most of the directors working in Hollywood are white men. Only a handful are black women. but they're doing big things in Tinseltown. I'm Farai Chidea. Our film series focuses on black women directors. Next time on News and Notes from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Kenneth Graham thinks his new home is a real deal.
There's no words to even describe free money.
Providence, Rhode Island enticed him to buy a foreclosed house with a no-interest loan.
It's hard to get someone excited when it's across the street from two houses that have been foreclosed that are boarded up.
One city's crusade to stop a surge of vacant homes.
It's like a cancer. It just grows and grows.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll look at when exercise for college kids becomes an addiction. Also, it's been 25 years. Why does Michael Jackson's Thriller still have a hold on us? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Richard Thompson Ford asks in his new book, When Are Complaints About Prejudice Valid and Appropriate? And When Are They Exaggerated, Paranoid, or Simply Dishonest? The book is called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. He says playing the race card hurts the work for civil rights. It breeds antagonism and mistrust between the races and prevents a real discussion about important racial issues. He's a professor of law at Stanford Law School. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, let's throw another topic in the hopper for our discussion here, and this has to do with affirmative action. How do you see affirmative action fitting into this conversation?
Well, I think affirmative action is an appropriate policy to integrate the nation's selective universities. Now, it is race discrimination as a formal matter. And in a way, it's a lot like racial profiling. So I'd like to juxtapose the two. In both cases, you've got a decision maker that considers race as one of a number of factors in order to promote some important social policy. In the case of police racial profiling, it's either drug interdiction or it's counterterrorism. In the case of affirmative action, it's promoting diversity in an integrated student body. In both cases, it's a generalization. When universities use race as a criterion, they're making a generalization about a racial group that they're going to contribute to classroom dialogue. Some people may not make distinctive contributions in the same way that some of the people who were profiled, you know, don't have drugs. It's also, at an individual level, somewhat unfair to individuals who are on the wrong side of the policy. It's unfair that I'm more likely to be subjected to a police stop than a white person. And it's unfair to white applicants in affirmative action, but the level of unfairness is relatively mild in both cases, and it's appropriate, I think, in circumstances where the social goal is important enough, and I think integration is important enough a goal.
Well, and the obvious counterexample of that is an individual person who, let's say, is Asian American. You know, family came to the country a generation or two ago. They had nothing to do with slavery
right.
In this country. They're a good student. They've proven themselves. They feel as if a black student is chosen over them for this idea of integration, that they have been discriminated against, that the race card has been played against them because they are not the right color.
Right. Well, you know, I think that the important thing to say is that it's not a question of whether someone was responsible for the discrimination directly. So the idea should never be it's okay for us to have this policy that disadvantages you because your ancestors benefited from slavery. That's not the issue. The issue is, as a society or as an institution, what's appropriate for the institution. And argument here is the institutions have good reasons to want to consider race, to want to promote racially integrated student bodies, and they are, I think, entitled to set the criterion that are appropriate for the institutional purposes, and that's not just grades and test scores.
So that person who doesn't get selected because it doesn't fit this model of integration, they're just out of luck? Wrong person, wrong place, wrong time.
Well, in the same way that many, many people who aren't admitted to selective schools are out of luck for many, many reasons that don't have to do with what we consider to be individual merit. Schools discriminate on the basis of region and location. If you live in a part of the country that's underrepresented, you're more likely to get in. They discriminate on the basis of alumni status. If your parents were alumni, there's a huge benefit. You know, that doesn't have anything to do with the individual merit of the student. So in each case, someone could complain that they weren't being evaluated simply according to their individual merit. But I think we understand that the institution's entitled to its own, to promote its own policies if the goals are important enough. And it strikes me that racial integration in a university setting is more important, for instance, than regional diversity or alumni preferences.
You like the word integration. Do you like the word diversity?
You know, I have some doubts about the word diversity. I suppose what I want to say about diversity is that it shouldn't be the sole criterion for affirmative action. And I think we've gotten a lot of rhetoric around diversity that as a result of Supreme Court decisions, which have said diversity is almost the only valid reason for a university to have affirmative action, I really think that integration is a better rationale, and that diversity, especially when we talk about it as a pedagogical matter, that racial integration is going to improve classroom discussions. That, you know, it's true in some cases and not in others.
Right.
And I don't think it should be the only reason.
But when you say integration and not diversity, is integration about race only, and diversity is more inclusive than that? I mean, what's the difference in your mind? Then we'll get back to our caller.
Well, the difference in my mind is that the diversity rationale, as the courts have set it up, really is it's a pedagogical claim. It's the idea is that people of color will come in with distinctive experiences, and those will improve the classroom conversation. And that strikes me that that's plausible in some fields and much less plausible in others. Plausible at a law school, you know, kind of harder to make the case in a math department or an engineering department that there's a distinctively black perspective on math. But integration, we're really saying we want to see more people of color in these fields. And there, the rationale applies across the board. It's quite plausible to say it would be a good thing to have more black mathematicians to encourage, you know, black students to get into math and to improve. And you don't, so that's a slightly different rationale.
Let me get back to our callers. We've got Paul from Bucks County joining. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Yes. In policing, at the end of every month, there is something called a uniform crime report, which is submitted to the FBI for a summary to track trends in both regional, state, and national levels. And on the UCR, the FBI UCR report, it also breaks it down by age group and race, those committing crimes and being arrested. In that report,
well, Paul, if you don't mind, just if you can just make your point, that'd be good because we got a lot of callers.
Yeah, 56% of all the rapes and murders in America are committed by African American males between the age of 15 and 40. That's 4% of the population. There should be profiling.
Well,
on that fact alone.
Well, let me see if my guest agrees with you.
Well, you know, I'd like to look at those statistics. That's actually a very surprising statistic to me. If the claim is that the number of the disproportionate number of African Americans are arrested and incarcerated for crime, generally, absolutely, that's true. I think some of that has to do with higher crime rates, and some of it has to do with more policing and you know more focus being placed on African Americans. And it's kind of hard to sort those out. As I've already said, I think sometimes racial profiling is appropriate when the data is strong enough and the profile is detailed and specific enough. So, you know,
Well, and his question makes me think of that debate about crack cocaine and powder cocaine. The idea that someone found with crack cocaine would get a stiffer sentence than someone with powder cocaine, and it turned out that, that African Americans were more likely to be scooped up when it came to crack cocaine, and white suburban Americans more associated with powder cocaine. Racial profiling, racism, race card?
Right, complicated question. I think that's a really complicated question. You know, the crack cocaine trade had devastating consequences for black communities in particular, and a way that the powder cocaine trade didn't. So there's a, you know, there is an argument to be made that crack cocaine was a bigger problem and warranted stiffer sentences. Now, having said that, my own view is that the extremely punitive approach of the war on drugs to drug crimes has been a catastrophe. It's been bad, very bad for black communities, and I don't think it's been an effective crime prevention strategy. The result has just been a lot of people in jail. You know, the state of California spends an enormous amount of money on jails. Mm-hmm. The United States it jails more of its population than any other industrialized country in the world. So I do think we need to rethink that, but I'm not so sure about the claim that it's racism, that disparity.
But it had this either intended or unintended consequence of penalizing one segment of the population over another.
That's right.
Let me get Thomas from East Norriton to join us. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say that if right now it seems to be that we're attacking this problem fragmentally instead of looking at it as encompassing the whole institutionalized racism, which permits the prevalence of the inequities that occur on towards the African American race. If we look at it from an institutional racism prejudice perspective, we're able to see why your callers will call in and look at little different fragments that show where we lead. But if you acknowledge the institutional racism aspect, you will see that this makes it prevalent and it perpetuates the myth because of the mindset from the institution. And it will then trickle down to make a self-fulfilling prophecy by saying yes, it is African Americans because we have this statistic and this statistic, but the statistics are loaded because it's the same institutions who are making it impossible or impediments for us to correct this mindset.
Well, Thomas, I think I understand what you're talking about, and I'm tossing it over to our guest. What do you think? I mean, he's saying, you know, you can find instances of this, that, and the other, but you need to look at the larger sort of institutional racism that plagues the country.
Right. I mean, I agree with that. I mean, one of the points I make in my book in the chapter called Racism Without Racists is that we have racial inequities that are kind of built in as a result of racism in the past, as a result of class hierarchies and as a result of the often very harsh conditions of the competitive market economy that makes it difficult for people to get jobs, and we need to look at that. What I want to move away from a little bit, though, is the idea that we should call someone a racist when confronting those problems. I think we would have a more productive conversation if we said we have racial inequities that are being perpetuated, and it's a social problem that needs to be dealt with comprehensively, and in that sense, I really agree. Unfortunately, I think the language of institutionalized racism has very quickly led people to point the finger of blame at the people involved in the institution and say they're racists. And that distracts attention away from the real problems and makes it harder, I think, for us to have a conversation.
What do we do, though, about real racists
exist? You know, then we do what we've always been doing. We absolutely attack real racists with the same level of moral condemnation that we always have.
Let me get to Janelle from Tom's River to join us. Hi, Janelle. Go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to ask your guest if he had any opinion on some of the negative drawbacks that black students face with affirmative action. Personally, when I got into school, I found myself having to justify the fact that I deserved to be. I actually went to Stanford, actually had felt like I had to justify the fact that I deserved to be there because people sort of felt like, oh, well, you're just here because of affirmative action, so maybe you're not as smart. And so you end up having to reprove yourself, which is something that you've done as black students, we've done in school, you know, all the way through, having to prove the fact that we're capable. And does that speak to the nature of affirmative action, and maybe it should be geared towards helping students who have been affected by the history of this country and insofar as paying for school and not simply admission?
Well, that's interesting, Janelle. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think what you're describing is a drawback of affirmative action. It's a real problem. My own view is that in at least many cases, it's worth it. And it's just a question of trade-offs at that point. Is it worth it to have an integrated student body with a significant African-American population, even though you'll have some people who make the kind of assumption that you've described? I think it is. I also think that if we started to look at affirmative action in the context of the broader admissions policies, and we understood that the universities don't just admit everyone else on the basis of grades and test scores. We don't believe that grades and test scores are merit, first of all. We think that they're an indicia of merit that's imperfect, and there are other things, and sometimes correcting for them by considering other factors is the, you know, gets us a better student body, first of all. And second of all, the university, for a variety of good reasons, has preferences for a whole range of people, not just people of color, but again, alumni preferences, preferences for people from regions of the country that are underrepresented, preferences for people with unique backgrounds and skills that don't have to do with race. That, you know, that argument that you don't deserve to be here because you got affirmative action would be less plausible.
Janelle, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me shift gears. We only have a minute or so before we have to say goodbye, but we're obviously in the middle of a presidential race here.
Yes.
And I wonder, are you seeing people playing the race card in this race to the White House?
Yes, and you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is the way anyone can play the race card. It's become kind of a national patois, so it's not a matter of just people of color playing the race card or mau-mauing white. In the election, I think it's fair to say that it's been the Clinton campaign that's played the race card much more frequently. One of Clinton's advisors, for instance, said or pollsters said the Latino or the Hispanic voter hasn't shown much propensity to vote for black candidates. And I thought, I talked to several experts on Hispanic politics who said, well, you know, that's not really true. Mayor Tom Bradley in Los Angeles, David Dinkins in New York, Harold Washington, Charlie Rangel, these are all black candidates that got significant Hispanic support. I had to come to the conclusion that they were kind of trying to poison the well by making this comment to whip up tension between African Americans and Hispanics so that Hispanics would be less likely to vote for Obama. So that's one example of playing the race card. And you know, there's also been this attempt to kind of box Obama into a bind. On the one hand, he's winning because he's black, because of racial block voting. He's kind of a narrow candidate that will only appeal to black voters like Jesse Jackson, as President Clinton suggested in South Carolina. On the other hand, he's not black enough, as some of Clinton's supporters like Robert Johnson, who said, well, he's a kind of Sidney Poitier, kind of guess who's coming home to dinner black, or even Andrew Young, a man for whom I have a great deal of respect, but said, Hillary's got Bill behind her, and Bill is as black as Barack, you know, which I thought was a kind of unfortunate statement, and again, an attempt to sort of make Obama look like inauthentic.
Well, much more to talk about. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And our guest has been Richard Thompson Ford. His book is The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse, and it's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And you